Hey, it's Brian Curtis from The Ringer, and I want to tell you about the Press Box podcast. The Press Box is a podcast for anybody who likes news, whether it's about sports or politics or pop culture, and wants to understand how that news really gets made. We have new shows every Monday and Thursday. We have long interviews with everyone from John Krakauer to Joe Buck. Your social media feeds are bursting with information every day. Let us help you sort it out. Join us on the Press Box.
It's Off the Pike, presented by FanDuel. April showers bring a loaded sports calendar, and FanDuel is the place to bet on it all. Right now, you can check out the new and improved Parlay Hub. Filter by odds, sport, and bet type to easily find the most popular parlays and same-game parlays all on one page. Plus, start betting on the Explore page and the Pulse and get paid instantly when you win. So download the app today and bet with FanDuel, America's number one sportsbook. The Ringer is committed to responsible gaming. Please visit rg-help.com to learn more about the resources and helplines available and listen to the end of this episode for additional details. Must be 21 plus and present in select states. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER or visit rg-help.com.
This episode is brought to you by Atlassian. Atlassian software like Jira, Confluence, and Loom help power the collaboration needed for teams to accomplish what would otherwise be impossible alone. Because individually we're great, but together we're so much better. That's why millions of teams around the world, including 75% of the Fortune 500, trust Atlassian software for everything from space exploration and green energy to delivering pizzas and podcasts. Whether you're a team of 2, 200, or 2 million, Atlassian software is built to keep you connected and moving together as one.
Welcome into Off the Pike. I'm Brian Barrett, flying solo today. A nice Saturday for the winter teams. The Celtics, of course, respond after the Nuggets lost. They beat the Suns in Phoenix, and then the Bees get an easy win over the Penguins after an odd trade deadline for the Bruins. We'll get into that as well. But the big news, the end of the Mac Jones era. So Adam Schefter reported early Sunday morning that Mac is headed to the Jacksonville Jaguars, so a homecoming of sort for Mac, where he'll, of course, back up Trevor Lawrence. So the Mac Jones era results in a 6-round pick, apparently back to the Patriots for the quarterback that they selected 15th overall back in 2021. So when I think back now that it's over, how will you sort of remember the Mac Jones era? I know a lot of us don't want to remember how this went down, but it started with promise and then it just completely came crashing down. Like ordinarily when we see teams moving on from their quarterback just 3 years after they drafted him in the first round, it's usually all bad. Like Zach Wilson, for example, with the Jets. It's been all bad since he took over there in New York. Of course, ultimately, they signed Aaron Rodgers prior to last season or traded Aaron Rodgers prior to last season. But the point with this is just the fact that you had moments with Mac, and then ever since that rookie season, it's been completely downhill. And it's crazy to me, and I'm sure a lot of you feel the same way, that for a moment there, and maybe for more than a moment, we were in on Mac, and then we were completely just out on Mac. So, full disclosure, I never wanted the Patriots to draft Mac Jones. I was doing a draft show at my former employer, WEI, and I didn't like the pick. Now, I wanted Justin Fields. Clearly, the book is still out on Justin Fields, too. The Bears are likely to trade him. Of course, they have that number one pick. And it may turn out that he's also just completely a bust. But I wanted Justin Fields at the time. I wanted the Patriots to trade up and make sure they got him. Remember, the Bears came over the Patriots to, of course, select Justin Fields. Not that the Patriots, apparently, they weren't going to take him anyway. But my point being is the Bears traded up to get Fields. So the reason, or part of the reason at least, that I didn't really want Mac Jones and I wasn't super interested in Mac Jones is it was more, if you look at the trend of the NFL, it felt like the Patriots were going against the recent trend of successful quarterbacks in the NFL, right? It's been more about mobile quarterbacks that could throw on the run. Not necessarily running quarterbacks. Fields can obviously do that. But it was more about quarterbacks that had these high upsides, right? We're thinking about the Josh Allens of the world, where it's like, okay, there's some rawness to his game, but if he gets right, this guy's going to be an absolute stud. This guy's going to be an absolute superstar. And with Mac Jones, I just saw, okay, maybe the floor could be high. We'd find out that the floor wasn't high, but the ceiling was also going to be pretty damn low. And I just feel like it's not worth taking a quarterback 15th overall or in the first round at all if he didn't have a high upside. But I have to admit, like this whole roller coaster that I'm talking about with Mac, I have to admit that after what we saw in his first regular season, I felt really optimistic. I was in. And I was saying, what a genius offseason by Bill Belichick, right? He signed a fringy defensive player of the year candidate in Matthew Judon. Remember, Judon was awesome. He's been awesome since he became a Patriot. But really, he was not in the defensive player of the year conversation. But the first 13 games or so, he was outstanding. And then he sort of tailed off at the end of the season. And I was thinking to myself, how rare is it that you could get your franchise quarterback going forward and a defensive player of the year caliber player? Not that he's ever going to win one, but the way that he played for the first 12, 13 games or so, he played like one. That's an outstanding offseason for Bill. And then after that, it just completely backfired for not just me, but the Patriots organization, right? You look at the first game that Mac had, they ended up losing to the Dolphins, but he's 29 of 39. He throws for 281, 102.6 passer rating, and you felt like, whoa, the Patriots may actually have something here. And then the Brady return game, Mac was pretty good. He battled in that tough, or those tough conditions that night at Gillette, right? 31 of 40, which is 77.5%, two touchdowns, a pick, a 101.6 pass rating. I felt like coming out of that game, even though the Patriots, I think at the time they dropped to what, 1-3, you felt like, okay, Mac was up for the challenge with Tom Brady coming back to the building. Not that I ever thought that he'd be close to that level, but you feel like, okay, they may have something here in Mac Jones. Like, it looked like, okay, maybe Mac could be a successful quarterback. But anyway, then the Patriots, they have that winning streak where they win 7 in a row. They get the number one seed. And I know a couple of those games you look at and you say, okay, one of the wins was against the Bills in the famous win game where Mac Jones only threw the ball 3 times, right? Which is still crazy to think back to that game that he only threw the ball 3 times in an NFL game. And the Patriots got some breaks along the way during their winning streak. Remember, A.J. Brown didn't play and Derrick Henry didn't play when the Patriots beat the Tennessee Titans. You had no Nick Chubb in the game the Patriots beat the Browns. And Sam Darnold was just awful, I should say, in the win that they had over the Panthers. But you still felt like, all right, like, this is pretty good. Like, the Patriots right now, when they went to that bye week prior to the Indy game, you look at it and you say, the Patriots have the number one seed in the AFC. You felt like you were onto something, not only just with Mac, but with the team in general in the post-Tom Brady era. And then the rest of the season after the bye week did not go well. They dropped 3 of 4. They dropped that primetime Saturday night game to the Indianapolis Colts. Mac had 2 picks in that game. They then lose to Buffalo. Mac has 2 interceptions in that one. And of course, the Patriots got killed in the playoffs. But even after that season, you felt like, okay, there's optimism coming out of it, even though it didn't go the way you wanted after the playoff loss and losing 3 of 4 at the end of the regular season. And maybe I personally, or and maybe you and the fan base, some of you guys agree as well, should have looked more closely at how that season ended. I still felt pretty good about it, but Mac Jones was not good down the stretch of the season. The Patriots as a team were not, so maybe we should have paid a little bit more attention to what was going down at the end of the season. But nonetheless, I still felt pretty good entering the 2022 season. And I remember going into 2022 thinking, there's actually more that this Patriots team can do. Remember, if you look back to what they did Mac's first year with Josh McDaniels, he only attempted 32 passes out of RPOs, and he was the best RPO quarterback at the collegiate level in 2020 when he played at Alabama and won the national championship. I felt like, okay, this is something they can take advantage of more. He was at 27.7% in terms of his dropbacks out of play action, which was only 14th, yet his numbers were really good. He had the 6th best completion percentage out of play action at 71.6%. So I felt like, okay, Josh McDaniels, he may have left some meat on the bone here, and they could dig into more of that stuff in 2022. And of course, the big thing that happens between 21 and 22 is McDaniels gets the Raiders job, which Mac lasted longer as a Patriot than Josh McDaniels lasted as a Raider. But nonetheless, the Patricia era begins. And by the way, the play action numbers go completely down. 16.2% for Mac, 40th out of 41 qualifiers in terms of their dropbacks out of play action. But the big thing here is we all saw this coming. We in the fan base, everybody in the media, everybody across the league looked at this situation and said, hold on, this is going to be a mess. Matt Patricia has been a defensive coach for the majority of his career. He's obviously never called offensive plays. You have him being the offensive play caller and the line coach. Like, the line coach is a difficult job in and of itself enough, and you have him doing both those jobs. And it just completely backfired. And it started, remember, in the preseason. We had all the reports coming out of training camp, like, the offense does not look good. And later on after the season, of course, our buddy Andrew Callahan had the write-up in the Herald about how bad that offense was, to the point where in meetings, players would ask the coaching staff, of course, Matt Patricia and Joe Judge, hey, what if the defense does this? What do we do? And they didn't have answers to it, right? They tried to sort of go to that Kyle Shanahan offense, never worked for the Patriots, not because it's not a good offense, but because they did not have the coaching staff that was capable of running that offense, right? They hadn't run it. So it was just so bad. They were also actively hurting Mac, I should say, in other ways too. They didn't play their best receiver at times in Kendrick Bourne, remember, because he was in Matt Patricia's doghouse. So you took away one of his best weapons from the previous season, although Jacoby Myers was their best receiver. But you get the point. They took away one of his best weapons just because Matt Patricia had an issue with them. And the whole time, there was a lack of weapons to begin with, and you weren't playing one of the better ones. And the scheme was bad, as we alluded to, right? And then you have this whole quarterback controversy with Bailey Zappe, right? Which carries all the way over to the following offseason, where Bill, before this season, wouldn't even commit to Mac as his guy, right? So then you had, going back to the original moment, you had the Bears game where Mac starts on Monday Night Football, and then he's yanked in favor of Bailey Zappe, and they said, hey, this was the plan all the time. We wanted to see how Mac's health was and how he would respond, and it was just a dumb decision because you already had sort of some momentum growing for Bailey Zappe because of the way that he played in Mac's absence, even though we've been over this on the pod. What Zappe was asked to do was very simplistic because of the teams they were playing. It was heavy play action. One of those games, he had the highest expected completion percentage in the entire NFL. So you get the point. But even though I can point this out, and I did at the time, that this is an easy offense for Zappe to run, I can also look at the fact and say, hey, Mac had not played well up until that particular point in time. He was turning the ball over like crazy. So there was a lot of momentum in the fan base. Hey, maybe Zappe is actually better than Mac Jones. So when you have Mac on the field for just what, those 3-4 series, and then you bring in Zappe, that's only going to add to that quarterback controversy, which you would imagine you don't want to have as a football team. The Patriots clearly had that. But after the season, I thought, even after that season where Mac was absolutely horrible in 2022, I thought, you know what, and I will also add this, I didn't like the way that he handled himself in 2022, and I can understand why he was aggravated, because of Matt Patricia and his inability to call offense and his inability to game plan. But jumping up and down on the field, that type of stuff irked me. That type of stuff irritated me. And I think that stuff irritates the team. Not only irritates the team, but it sends the wrong message to the team, right? Where you're a quarterback. By default, you have to be a leader. Even if you're not the most vocal leader, like, say, a Tom Brady, you have to lead by at least example. And Mac didn't do that with the way that he handled himself, with the behavior all the time on the field, jumping up and down, complaining, etc. And also, publicly taking shots at the coaching staff. Remember, he'd say, oh, play action's cool, RPOs are cool. And it's fine for me to say, they should be doing more of this stuff. But for Mac to be talking about that publicly, I quite frankly don't think that was the best idea. But anyway, even after that season, I felt like, hey, this was so bad with Matt Patricia. If they just get a real professional offensive coordinator in here, it could work again, right? Now, I never thought that Mac would ever be elite, but can he just be slightly above average or a little bit more than that like he was in his rookie season? I didn't think that was out of the realm of possibility if you just brought in a competent offensive coordinator. So the Patriots, I was not crazy about the Bill O'Brien idea because I thought there's more innovative guys out there, but I did like some of the stuff Bill O'Brien was saying, going back to this whole idea of, hey, more play action, more RPOs. They ran a ton of RPOs where Bill O'Brien just came from, when, of course, he was coaching at Alabama and they had Bryce Young. So I felt like, okay, this is at the very least a significant upgrade over the guy that was calling plays last year in Matt Patricia. Even if I'm not the biggest fan of Bill O'Brien, it's going to be better. But that didn't happen either. Mac last season, 37th out of dropback in terms of dropback percentage out of play action, 19.5%, and just 27 passing attempts out of RPOs. And you can say, yeah, a lot of that had to do with the personnel up front. They couldn't protect Mac, so when that happens, you don't have your full playbook, so to speak, at your disposal. And I totally understand that, but I don't think Bill O'Brien was very innovative with the offense last season. And on top of all that with the Patriots last season, the offensive line was a complete mess. They signed a guy in Riley Reiff, who was a journeyman tackle that had just been playing the past 2 years for really bad offensive lines. The Patriots thought, we can bring him here because he's cheap, instead of going after a guy that's going to cost us a lot of money, and we'll be fine. Well, the problem was, he wasn't good during training camp to the point that they put him at guard. He got hurt and he never played for the Patriots. So you have this hole at tackle for the whole season because of that move of the offseason. The Patriots offensive line this past season ranked 29th of 32 teams in pass block grade via Pro Football Focus. So they were legitimately one of the worst pass blocking units in the NFL. And that number, that ranking, I should say, sort of matches the eye test that we saw, right? It was predictable that this was going to happen, though, based on the offseason that they had. And then Mac was 29th of 30 qualifiers in EPA plus completion percentage over expectation. Only Zach Wilson was worse. He was behind guys like Kenny Pickett. He was behind guys like Bryce Young. He was behind guys like Aiden O'Connell. And he was also just 28th of the NFL in EPA per play for a quarterback. So he was unequivocally one of the worst quarterbacks in the NFL. He had some just awful interceptions. You think to the Colts game where you have a chance to win that thing, Mac throws a late interception. You think about some of the other games. The Cowboys game in particular sticks out to me. Remember, he got away with throwing a ball across the field, and then he did it again and threw an interception. Also, like when he's rolling to his right, throws one right to Curse. He just had so many bad moments. He was pulled in back-to-back games against the Cowboys, against the New Orleans Saints, and then after that, he just kept losing his job till ultimately they decided that Bailey Zappe was a better option at quarterback for the remainder of the season. So it just, and this is even after the beginning of the season where you felt like, hey, after the Philly game, that looked pretty good. Remember 316 passing yards. He had the three touchdowns. You're like, okay, maybe this will work again for Mac Jones. And then it just completely came crashing down, as we alluded to, with the benchings that he had throughout the season as well. So I think all parties are to blame for what happened with Mac Jones. But first with Mac, like the Patriots are to blame, Mac's to blame, everybody's to blame in this thing, right? It's not like, hey, just Mac was horrible, he was never going to be good, and it's not just like the Patriots, it's all their fault, they ruined Mac Jones. Because I think there's a lot of truth to both sides, but you think about it. First with Mac, I believe my initial reaction now, going back to when they drafted him, was the correct one. He didn't have much of an upside, right? You could see a scenario, though, where everything else around him goes right. And he looks like a competent quarterback and a better than competent quarterback like he did in 2021. But he was never going to be the guy that sort of carried the franchise. He doesn't have elite skills. He doesn't have a good arm for NFL standards. Obviously, for a normal human being, he has a great arm. But for an NFL quarterback, he doesn't have a good arm. He's not athletic. He can't throw on the run. And he's become turnover prone. So he doesn't protect the football. So none of those elite skills you need to have to play quarterback at the NFL level as a starter week in, week out, Mac doesn't have any of them, right? And the way that Mac handled himself, it became unbecoming of a starting quarterback. You can't have all the bad body language showing up the Patriots coaching staff. Part of the position, as we mentioned, you have to be better than that if you're the quarterback of the team. So I would even say leadership, that's the skill of being a quarterback. Mac doesn't have that. But I think we also have to acknowledge that this was, some of the examples I gave, a masterclass on how to ruin a young quarterback. An offensive coordinator that never called plays in Patricia. You changed the system three different times. He had three different offensive coordinators. Minimal weapons. Bad offensive lines. A quarterback controversy. I don't know what else you could add into it to ruin a quarterback. What else could you possibly do? Threaten his job on multiple occasions. Give him bad offensive lines, give him bad play callers. I don't know, and give him bad weapons, or not good enough weapons, right? I don't know what else you could do to ruin a young quarterback. And look, we all know that Kraft loved Mac, and there was this whole idea that he pushed Mac on Bill. But I do think this also, clearly, it has to reflect poorly on Belichick. And look, Mac may just stink, and that's probably just the reality. Mac is not a good NFL quarterback. But the problem is, he continually got worse. And a lot of that is on the coaching staff and it's on the roster building, right? It's on the GM of the team or de facto GM in Bill Belichick, where the roster kept getting worse, the quarterback got worse as well. The Patriots didn't do nearly enough to help Mac Jones. So this was an entire organizational failure. So I'm not defending Mac here. And I'm glad that Mac is out of the picture here. I'm glad that era of Patriots football is over because I do not ever want to watch Mac Jones play football in a Patriots uniform again. It's best for both parties to sort of move on from this situation. Hopefully Mac can get his career back on track as a backup in Jacksonville And hopefully it's a better place for him than the Patriots were the past couple of years, because it didn't work out for Mac. And he's going to be a backup now going forward. I mean, that's ultimately what he's going to do. Now, maybe he can have a Baker Mayfield-like renaissance where he gets an opportunity to start. Lawrence is a guy that's gone down with some injuries in the past. Maybe he gets an opportunity and he shines. I don't have any ill will towards Mac whatsoever, but I just look at it and I say, going forward, this is one of the biggest things that sort of hurt the end of the Belichick era here, right? Because you sort of think about it, right? This is what happens with bad organizations. You think about the Jets with Darnold and then with Zach Wilson. And as I mentioned, maybe these guys just stink, but the Jets didn't do enough to help those guys. This is what happens with the Browns with Johnny Manziel, the Titans with Jake Locker, the Vikings with Christian Ponder, the Browns with Brady Quinn, right? I never thought the Patriots would be the team with the bad rookie quarterback. And I never thought Bill Belichick would be the guy that couldn't take advantage of a quarterback on a rookie contract. And the problem with Bill mainly is he didn't draft well around the quarterback. So then that meant they had to go out and spend a lot of money in 2021 in that offseason. And they weren't good in the free agency department. Even if you go back to as recently as this year, when we talk about the free agency situation, you had a receiver that worked out really well for you, that had good chemistry with your young quarterback and Mac Jones with Jacoby Myers. They decided to move on from Jacoby Myers, and the Juju Smith-Schuster thing, the guy wasn't healthy. So I totally understood the idea of getting a guy that was going to be better after the catch and more explosive and all that stuff, but I thought they felt good about the medical. So even one of the guys that Mac was good with, you decided to move on from him. So I guess the biggest thing you could say about Bill having bad draft after bad draft recently, although I do like last year's draft. You know how I feel about Christian Gonzalez. But the point being here is the best thing the Patriots fans and the Patriots organization, and I guess you'd say the crafts because they're still running this organization, right? They still own the team, obviously. The biggest thing that they got out of this whole Mac Jones situation is at least you get another crack at it. You have the third overall pick in the draft. You have a chance to develop a franchise quarterback. And Mac Jones, by being so bad, and the Patriots being so bad, putting the proper team around him, they have an opportunity now to cash in on that. And look, if I sound harsh on the Patriots, they deserve to be criticized for how they handle Mac. I don't think anybody, even the biggest Belichick supporter in the world, could say they did the right things around the quarterback. Even if you think the quarterback was never going to work, that was not a good enough team for, quite frankly, any quarterback. Like, it's just not an appealing roster what they had over the past couple of years. And the other thing that I would say, too, is with Mac Jones going, like, just thinking about from a perception standpoint, everybody loved Mac here after year one. And now nobody could stand him after that. We're all sick and tired of it. It's amazing he went from, hey, he's beloved, he could be the next guy for the Patriots, to, damn, this guy stinks. I mean, it's amazing how quickly that happens. But anyway, the one other thing I mentioned about the Mac situation is Bailey Zappi liked the NFL's post on Instagram that Mac got traded, which is kind of funny to me. I think he really believes he's getting the job. And I think it was Callahan that told us, like, Zappi's one of the most confident people you'll ever meet. He was 40th in yards per attempt last season at 6.0 out of 45 qualifiers. His passer rating was 68.8, which was 44th out of 45 qualifiers. Like, everybody knows the Patriots are taking somebody with the third overall pick. And we knew the Patriots were going to take a quarterback third overall. So I don't think, like, trying to connect the fact that the Patriots traded Mac means, oh, they're comfortable with May and Daniels. They already were. It wasn't like Mac had anything to do with their decision going forward. It's not like, hey, if we don't take one, at least we have Mac Jones. No, they weren't going to have Mac Jones be the starter next year anyway. Anyway, so we enter free agency now. Calvin Ridley has been reported as a target. Jeremy Fowler had that. We talked about this briefly the other day with Zach Cox. So one other thing is this. Jerry Jeudy gets traded to the Browns for a fifth and a sixth. And we know he's had his issues in Denver. But this is a guy that I was interested in last year for the Patriots before the season. Remember, I was talking about on the pod that, hey, this is a guy that maybe they should trade for. So last year, he's at 47 yards a game. The year before that, 64. And here's the thing. And this is why I thought, okay, a fifth and a sixth, and that's all it costs to get Jerry Jeudy, a former first-round pick. And I know that he hasn't lived up to the first-round pick billing. But if you're only going to have to give up a fifth and a sixth, it may be worth taking a chance on him, right? So this is why I thought, okay, this even makes more sense with Elliott Wolf. Elliott Wolf talked about in his press conference at the Combine that they're looking for weapons with after-the-catch ability. Well, Jerry Jeudy, that's one of the things he does. He's one of the best in the NFL. If you look at next-gen stats, 6.2 yak per reception last year. When he didn't have a great season, that's 12th among receivers and tight ends last year. 2 years ago, 6.3, same ranking, 12th. So this is the type of guy that I wish the Patriots had been in on more, because look, Ridley, if you sign him, he's not a true number one and he's going to cost you a ton of money. I would have just taken a shot on a guy like Jerry Jeudy to see what you could get out of the player, considering the fact that he's had his moments in the NFL and he has a skill set that you would think Elliott Wolf would be interested in. So we'll see how free agency goes as that gets underway on Monday. But I felt like that was a missed opportunity for the Patriots, considering how barren their receiver situation is. That's a guy that I would have been interested in. All right, coming up next, I want to get into the Celtics as they beat the Suns. I have a take on the two best players. So one on Jason Tatum, one on Jaylen Brown. We'll get into that next. FanDuel's putting the ball in your court for the rest of the NBA season, because right now new customers get $200 in bonus bets with any winning $5 bet. That's $200 if your bet wins. So I'm looking at the Celtics and the Blazers coming up on Monday night. So how about this, the same game parlay? We'll take the Celtics on the money line. Derek White, 2 made threes. Porzingis, 15 points after getting the rest, of course, on Saturday night. Porzingis, 2 made threes. So White, 2 made threes. Porzingis, 2 made threes. Porzingis, 15 points. And the Celts on the money line. Bet on the NBA with a wide range of bet types, including quick bets, live same-game parlays, player props, and more. And the wait is over. North Carolina, FanDuel is officially live in the Tar Heel State. So visit FanDuel.com/pike and make your first bet a layup. FanDuel, official sportsbook partner of the NBA. Must be 21 plus and present in select states. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER or visit theringer.com/RG. First online real money wager only. $10 first deposit required. Bonus issued as non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire 7 days after receipt. See terms at sportsbook.fanduel.com. Welcome back into Off the Pike. So the Celtics, of course, they're playing all these nationally televised games, going back to last Sunday against the Warriors. Then it's the Cavaliers on TNT. Then it's, of course, the Nuggets on TNT. And then they get the Suns in this ABC 8:30 game, which is really what, like 8:45 game. And they beat the Suns in that game last night. Of course, no Devin Booker for Phoenix, and the Celtics were without Kristaps Porzingis. Just a note from that game, because I don't want to get into specifics too much in this one, because I have some bigger, broader thoughts with the team after they bounce back from the Denver loss. Derek White, that block that he had on Royce O'Neal in transition was absolutely amazing, because he had passed O'Neal in the air, and he reached back with his right hand to be able to block that. Phenomenal. He ends up with, what, 9 assists in this game as well. But that was, to me, the highlight of the game. No Porzingis, as I mentioned. So I meant, like, more Luke Kornet. And I did feel like this is an awesome Luke Kornet game. He played 20 minutes. He goes for 14 points. He's 6 of 7 from the field. He has 6 rebounds, 3 of those offensive. All 6 of Kornet's makes are in the restricted area. Not that that's a surprise, because that's where he plays, right? Right around the basket. And half of his points, rather, were second chance points. And the others are dish-offs and lobs. And the offense, if you look at it on the season, the offense is slightly down with Kornet on the court. It's still an elite offense. It's just slightly down with him on the court. But and a lot of that is because a lot of the times he's not playing with Kristaps Porzingis. He's not playing with a guy that's like Kristaps Porzingis is an elite offensive player. So obviously when he's off the court and Kornet's on, those numbers are going to go down, right? So naturally. So it's not like a big indictment that the offense is down slightly when Kornet's on the court, but a couple of things are up. The rim frequency goes up by 2.2 percentage points. That's in the 82nd percentile via cleaning the glass. And so I do think he brings a certain thing to the table, which is important in your role players and your bench guys, right? You need guys to have specific roles and specific assignments. And Kornet's assignment, high pick and roll, and it's a different dimension, right? Where it's like, with Porzingis and with Al, a lot of times it's pick and pop. With Kornet, you know, it's just all getting downhill. That's his specific skill. Set screens, get to the rim, catch a lob, get offensive rebounds, hang out in the dunker spot, and get easy dish offs from the Derek Whites, the Jason Tatums, the Jaylen Browns of the world, right? So if you look at that, you're getting downhill more. So sometimes when your shots aren't falling, and in a game last night, you could tell, Durant talked about it after the game, they didn't want the Celtics to get up a lot of threes. He said there's been games, you know, they'll take more than 50 threes. We didn't want that. So they kept them under 40 attempts. They took 39. So when that's happening, when the team is so gung-ho to make sure, hey, we don't want you to take threes, you have to get downhill. And I think Cornette really helped the Celtics in that game because of the style of play. And then you look at the second chance points. As we mentioned, he had six last night. But you look at it on the season, and if you look at their second chance points per 100 possessions, with Cornette on the floor, they're at 17.9, and the Knicks lead the league at 17. So they're better than the best team in the NBA when Cornette's on the court. And they're at 13.9 when he's off the floor. That would rank around 15th. So you go from about league average to better than the best team in the NBA with second chance points. And you notice what it is. It's not just like, and I mentioned he had six second chance points, but it's not just like he gets an offensive rebound and he's trying to go right back up with it. One of the things he does is when a shot goes up, he gets really good interior position, and he just bats the ball out. We see this all the time with Cornette. So I wanted to bring that up just because I think throughout the season, especially in that game last night, Cornette was a really important player for the Celtics. And when you have a specific role like that, it's very important in terms of when you have an 82-game schedule. And I am interested, like, the one thing I would say is, I understand he didn't play much against the Nuggets. I think that's more of a matchup thing. But there's going to be a playoff game this year where Cornette has a game like this, that he has this sort of impact. Okay. And it's important, too, that guys like that, Cornette usually plays every game, right? So it's important to have a game like that where, hey, he doesn't play against Denver, doesn't get down on himself, has, I would argue, one of the better games he's had all season long against the Suns. So hats off to Cornette for that game. So I wanted to get into something with each star. So Tatum in that game on Saturday night goes 5 of 9 from three-point territory. And it was important to get your points up. What do you have, 29 points after the stinker in Denver? And the bigger thing to me was he grabbed 10 rebounds, because I mentioned it on the pod after the game on Thursday. The fact that he only had 4 rebounds, unacceptable. This is one of the premier rebounding forwards in the NBA. You need to be hitting the glass. And he did that in that game, of course, on Saturday night after being invisible on the boards on Thursday. So it's been a bizarre month for Tatum. And look, it's only 5 games, so it's not like this is a huge sample size or anything along those lines. But if you look at it, Tatum in that game on Saturday, he's 6 of 19 on twos, 31.6%. He's 1 of 6 on twos outside of the restricted area. And he was 2 of 10, or excuse me, he's 1 of 6 on twos outside of the paint. And he's 2 of 10 overall on twos outside the restricted area. So basically, the only time he's scoring is when he's like right at the basket. So if you look at Tatum this month, 5 of 9 from deep, of course, last night. So that means he's up to 21 of 37, 56.5% from deep. So he's really been shooting it well from outside. But he's just 22 of 57, 38.6% on twos. That's a horrible number, right? So look, I get it. Totally understand it's just a 5-game sample size. But that 2-point number, that would be by far the worst in the league if you did that out for the whole season. Gary Trent is last among qualifiers at 44%. Tatum was having his best career season from two until very recently, because now he's gone from last year he's at 55.8% on twos, this year he's down to 55.4%. And he was north of 56% prior to the start of the month. So he's really struggled in terms of his 2-point shooting, yet his 3-point numbers have been awesome, which you love to see. But the reason I bring that up is just this. Tatum's shooting, the consistency of his shooting has been up and down, and we've seen it in the playoffs at times as well, right? I mean, you think about last year, the first 11 games of the playoffs, so the Atlanta series and the first 5 against Philly, he averages his 26.9, but he only shoots 33.3% from deep. It was actually Jaylen that was carrying the offense in terms of he was shooting 47.5% from deep. He was hitting everything from outside. And then it really turned for Tatum in that game 6, where he hits the big threes late against Philly, got Embiid matched up on him a bunch in game 7, and he went for 51. He was awesome. Then in the Heat series, he had some really big games in that one, but he finished the series shooting poorly from three-point territory. So last year, it was the inconsistency at times with his three-point shooting. If you go back to the previous playoff run, the finals against the Golden State Warriors, his 2-point shooting was the problem. Remember, he shot 36.7% from the field and just 31.6% on his twos, 24 of 76. I mean, that's a horrible number, right? So this whole debate, the reason I bring this up with the consistency is like this whole debate, is Tatum a true superstar? The biggest thing is his consistency, right? Because he's an awesome rebounder, except that game, as I mentioned, against Denver. He is a great defensive player. He is a really good scorer. I mean, he's going to get you his 25 a night on most occasions, and most occasions he's going to get more than that in the 26 to 30 range over the past couple of years. That's usually where he's living. He's definitely improved as a playmaker as well, but the one thing is just the consistency with his shooting, which has been an issue over the years. So when we bring up this ultimate superstar, right now, I'd say he's in the second tier. He's not in the elites of the elites, the Nikola Jokic's. I wouldn't even put Shea in that category yet because I need to see him do it sort of in the postseason. But Giannis is in the elite of the elites. Curry's in the elite of the elites, right? I would, even though the Clippers have not played the best basketball post-All-Star break, I would put Kawhi in that category just because we've seen him do it at the highest level in the past before. As I said with Shea, I think he's still got to prove it in the postseason. Like, Tatum's had a lot more success in the postseason. Shea's barely been in the postseason in his career. But getting into that next group requires you to be more consistent from a game-in, game-out basis. Tatum will go on tears where he's awesome, but certain times, it's just like his shot leaves him, whether it's from three-point territory or it's the finishing in the interior. It's the fadeaways. It's his mid-rangers, and right now he's struggling from two-point territory. So it seems like we always have these conversations about Tatum at some point during the postseason, right? That's why I bring this up in terms of the shooting. It's like, I feel like every year we have these conversations, and he's still very young. Like, I want to make that abundantly clear. Most guys in NBA history don't have nearly as many playoff games as Jason Tatum has had at this point in their career. It doesn't happen. The guy's playing these many games. But I just wonder, are we going to have these same conversations this year in the postseason where it's like, hold on, Tatum needs to have this heroic game six against Milwaukee, because what was going on before that with the Celtics, right? And then, hey, he's got game six. If he doesn't hit those critical shots, the Celtics are in major trouble, right? And Tatum's probably getting the most criticism because he did not play well in that game up until the final minute. So it's just something to monitor, because I feel like every year we have these conversations about Tatum in the postseason. And I do think this team, to their credit, is uniquely built for other guys to step up. And we've seen that throughout the regular season already at times. But to me, the one true thing, or the one thing keeping Tatum from becoming a true superstar, is the consistency and not having these questions during the playoffs. Like, oh, can Tatum be better in this game? What happened to Tatum? Like if we don't have those questions this postseason, we're probably talking about a guy that's in the ultimate superstar category rather than, hey, he's almost there type of thing. Okay. A great sign for Jaylen. Now, we talked about the awesome game, of course, Jaylen played against Denver outside of the shooting. So he had 27 against Phoenix on Saturday night. Since the All-Star break, it's eight games. He's eighth in scoring at 28.1. He was at 22 points a game pre-All-Star break, which was 33rd. If you look at the numbers in terms of the shooting splits, 54.7% from the floor since the break, 42.3% from deep. Jaylen is also, since the All-Star break, eighth in the league in points in the paint at 15.3, right behind Anthony Davis and Zion, and right in front of Sabonis. He was at 10.6 points per game in the paint pre-All-Star break, which was 24th, so a huge increase there. So we're talking about, what, about a five-point increase, as we mentioned. So when you go from 22 points a game pre-All-Star break to 28.1 points per game post-All-Star break, and you have a five-point increase in points in the paint, it sort of tells you the story. We have a more aggressive Jaylen Brown since the All-Star break, and a guy that is weaponizing his physicality getting into the lane. And he did the same exact thing post-All-Star break last year, and this is really why he got All-NBA, is because of his post-All-Star break run. Now, he was playing really well pre-All-Star break. Obviously, he made the All-Star team, but post-All-Star break is when he really turned it on. Post-All-Star break, 15.5 points in the paint last year. That was fourth, as we mentioned. That number this year is the same, or pretty close to the same post-All-Star break, 15.3 compared to that 15.5. He's also, all season long, been awesome on pull-up twos. 101 of 205, which is 49.3%. He's having his best season on short mid-rangers. That's outside of 4 feet, and inside of 14 feet. He's 116 of 234, 49.6%. That is in the 91st percentile via cleaning the glass. And he's shooting now, and some of these are in the short mid-range, he is shooting 52% on fadeaways. And just to sort of put that into context, Kawhi's at 51.2%, Durant's at 48.4%, Jaylen is at 52% on fadeaways. So that's a real weapon that he can get to that shot in the postseason. And I've referenced this in the past. Sometimes your pretty game in the postseason, where you're bombing all these threes and you're hitting them, is not going to work. There's going to be a lot of games where the Celtics just blowing teams out in the postseason because their threes are falling. But sometimes your pretty game isn't going to be there, and you have to hit those difficult twos. Jaylen is doing that, and he's been doing it all season long. And probably the most important thing for Jaylen Brown post-All-Star break, we've talked about it before, where sometimes he doesn't show up in the impact metrics. If you look at Jaylen post-All-Star break, and this is before the games on Sunday, we're recording right now, it's 2:45. The Celtics with Jaylen on the court post-All-Star break are plus 130. That is second in the NBA behind only Nikola Jokic. And if you look at the Celtics, the closest guy to Jaylen in that category is Derek White at plus 113. So Jaylen has been number one on the Celtics post-All-Star break in plus-minus, number two in the entire NBA. If you look at the numbers with Jaylen off the court, they've only outscored teams by 2 points. And Derek White is the closest in that category at plus 19. So Jaylen, most of the time, the Celtics, by the numbers, and I'm not saying that you don't need Jaylen because he's a great player, but by the numbers, a lot of times they play better when Jaylen's off the court. It's been the complete opposite post-All-Star break. And I do think a lot of this goes back to, A, the defense he brings to the table where he's taking on these matchups all the time. And most importantly, the fact that we're seeing a more aggressive Jaylen Brown after the All-Star break for the second straight year where he's getting downhill and he's been incredible in terms of his fadeaway game, his pull-up two-point game, his fadeaway game. And since the All-Star break, as I mentioned with those numbers, he's shooting the three ball well as well. Okay, I wanted to mention one thing about Porzingis because, of course, he didn't play as we mentioned. But one thing about that Denver game. So I heard Zach Lowe from ESPN mention that they found some things the Celtics did if they play Denver hypothetically in an NBA Finals. So if you do look at it, one of the things he mentioned is Porzingis. So I was running through this. If you look at Porzingis' game against Denver, he was 3 of 10 from deep, okay? He was 1 of 3 on wide open threes, which means the closest defender is at least 6 feet away. He was 1 of 6 on open threes, which means the closest defender is 4 to 6 feet away. So A, those are good shots, but B, why are those shots happening? Because you can take advantage of Jokic in the pick and pop game, which is the point that Zach Lowe is making, rather than the pick and roll game, right? And the reason for that is Jokic, when it's a traditional pick and roll where he knows the guy's going downhill, he can come up to the level of the ball handler and play games with the ball handler and still retreat and get back to the roller and get in the way of the roller. But if it's the pick and pop guy, it's more difficult for him to get back out to the shooter. That's why you see those numbers of the amount of open and wide open threes that Porzingis was allowed to take in that game. It's easier for him on the roll guy than it is to get all the way out there. So one of the things the Nuggets did, they put Jokic on Drew. And Drew, remember, hit the two big shots late. He ends up going 3 of 5 on Jokic as the primary defender. So this is just something to keep in the back of your mind. It was a great point by Zach Lowe that Jokic, the fact that we looked at Porzingis' game and you're thinking, oh, 3 of 10, he wasn't great shooting the basketball. But the point is the process was right, where they were getting all these open opportunities. And if they get to a potential NBA Finals series, this is something that the Celtics will try to press this button. And you definitely want to make Jokic work as much as he possibly can on defense to try to at least tire him out or at least make it more difficult for the Nuggets to defend you. So those numbers are something that stuck out to me, is the amount of open opportunities Porzingis got, where I do think this is a difficult matchup for Jokic to get out to Porzingis shooting. So I'll be interested to see what they do if, I mean, we're a while away from that. Celtics still have to get through the East. The Nuggets still have to get to the West. But it is just something to keep in the back of your mind. I thought it was a great point by Zach Lowe. Okay, real quickly on the Bees. Fun Sunday after, or Saturday afternoon game, I should say, which they keep playing these afternoon games on Saturdays, which is a lot of fun. They beat the Penguins very easily in this game, 5-1. You had the awesome first period goal from Pasta to get to his 40th of the season. Marchand had a sick goal on a backhander after a coil feed. Marchand, too, had a sick feed to DeBrusk, who DeBrusk is getting going here, which is important when DeBrusk plays at this type of level where he's impactful. The Bruins are a much better team. So they've now won 2 in a row after the struggle that they've had post-All-Star break. Very important, especially, we mentioned the other day, getting the sweep over Toronto when this is a team that you possibly could match up in or most likely going to match up against in the first round of the playoffs. So I thought that was nice to see the way that the Bruins have responded over the past couple of games here. Now, one interesting thing, of course, because now we're post-trade deadline, and by now all of you have seen it in the comments, Ullmark, apparently the Bruins, there was a report that they had a deal done with Ullmark to go to the Kings, and he used his no-move clause. Ullmark, after the game on Saturday, which of course he won for the Bruins, he said, There's going to be some games you're going to take with you a little bit longer, obviously. I'm going to keep it a little bit in my memory bank, and you put it out there from time to time. Now, Don Sweeney was asked about this at his press conference in terms of the post-trading deadline, and he said, "You guys know me well enough. It's not coming from here in terms of what we're trying to explore and what other teams are asking about." So basically he's saying, yeah, that report, it's not leaked by me. Now, it's definitely true, because if it wasn't true, he just would have said, yeah, there's no truth to that. We didn't have a deal done with the Kings to send Omar to Los Angeles, right? So it's definitely true. But Don Sweeney's point was, we're not leaking this. So basically that means it's not coming from Omar. It's coming from the Kings side of things, right? That's what Don Sweeney wants to have out there. But anyway, he said, I made no bones about it that it was a real strength of this hockey club, but it was something we may have to do if it made our team ultimately better. And we didn't move in that direction. Of course, they didn't move in that direction because Omar said, no, I don't want to go there. And that's his right. He has it in his contract. I do think it's fascinating that so many NHL players have this in their contracts when it's basically non-existent in the NBA anymore. We see it in Major League Baseball. A lot of guys will have like a certain amount of teams. Like, for example, years ago, Zach Greinke, one of the teams he had on the list was the Red Sox, because he didn't want to play in a big media market like Boston. Remember, he ended up going to Houston for a couple of years. But anyway, my point is just the fact that it's just interesting to see this, that Omar plays really well post-trading deadline after he decides to invoke his no-trade clause. And it was reported by Kevin Weeks that essentially it was about location, didn't want to move his family. And I totally understand that from a personal level. Like, you can't hate on the guy for doing that, right? If you have this in your contract, there's a reason you worked that out. So I understand it. But it would have been interesting to see what the move the Bruins ultimately were going to make and how much better the team was going to be. But I do think in a weird way with this team in particular, this Bruins team, and I've mentioned multiple times that I thought, hey, they needed to add pieces, that this may actually be a rallying cry for this team. And you need this type of stuff as you get into the dog days, right, of the NHL season. This may actually help this team in terms of just the mentality standpoint, because everybody on the team loves Omar. You could see that, right? So I do think that could actually end up helping the team, although I still don't, when I look at this team and look, they beat Toronto four times, which is obviously awesome for a potential first round series. You see what Florida was able to add. You see what Colorado was able to add. I just don't see this as a true Stanley Cup contender like they've been, especially last year, but in previous seasons as well. I just don't see that with this team this year, but you see what they add. They added Pat Maroon, who right now is dealing with a back injury. He'll bring some physicality to the fourth line. We know what Pat Maroon's going to do. It is interesting with the whole Jack Edwards situation there. So remember last year, Jack Edwards, they were talking about Pat Maroon, and he said he's listed at 238 pounds. That was day one of training camp. I've got a feeling he's had a few more pizzas between then and now. So they met up last year. They had a conversation. Matt Porter, our buddy from the Globe, who's come on the pod a bunch of times, he says, looking forward to the next time we meet up. He'll never lose a fight now that he's wearing the right sweater on the Nesson Bruins telecast. So that's what Jack said, that now apparently they're all good, so that's not going to be an issue. You wouldn't expect it after they had a conversation. But so, okay, you get a little physicality there, and it felt like the Bruins were looking for that at the trading deadline. They wanted to get more physical, so you add a guy. I don't know what your expectations could be for Maroon at this point in his career. Where I know he's a three-time Stanley Cup winner, but he's, what, 35, 36 years old. The other guy you pick up is Andrew Peak. You needed another defenseman, especially considering Forbert's on long-term IR. And if you look at him on the season, I mean, look, he's playing for a horrible Columbus team. Absolutely atrocious. But if you look at the numbers, when he's on the ice, the goals expected for percentage, 38.9%, which is 242nd out of 248 defensemen that have played at least 200 5-on-5 minutes. So those numbers are not good. We'll see, though, if you get in a better situation. He is big, 6'3", 210 pounds. He in a better situation on a better team. We'll see. Maybe he ends up being somebody, like third line pairing, especially considering, as I mentioned, with the long-term IR for Forbert. But a very quiet trading deadline for the Bruins in terms of the additions. I know Maroon, kind of some controversy there with what we talked about. But Omar not getting traded, there's some sort of drama there as he invokes the no-trade clause. But at the same time, it's not like the Bruins made any big splashy move that maybe people were hoping for. All right, coming up next, we'll bring in producer extraordinaire Jamie McClellan.
This episode is brought to you by Lincoln and the all-new 2024 Nautilus Hybrid. Featuring a customizable 48-inch panoramic display, available Revel audio system, and available perfect position front seats with active motion massage. Oh my God, the world isn't wide enough. Visit Lincoln.com to learn more. Some models, trims, and features may not be available or may be subject to change. Check with your local retailer for current information. Lincoln and Nautilus are trademarks of Ford or its affiliates. This episode is brought to you by Major League Baseball. A lot is going on in the world of sports right now, but don't forget the 2024 baseball season. It's officially here. Some pretty exciting things to look forward to. Can the star-studded Dodgers, can they make the World Series? Can Mookie Betts break my heart again? How about the young Orioles? How about the defending champs, the Rangers, trying to become the first back-to-back champs in over two decades? See how far they'll go. Get in on the action by visiting your local ballpark or any ballpark, or you can just go to MLB.com, tap the banner to learn more. Baseball is something else.
Welcome back into Off the Pike. Joining us now, producer extraordinaire Jamie McClellan. Jamie, what's going on, man? How are you?
I'm good, Brian. Trying to process all my feelings at the end of the Mac Jones era. It's been a roller coaster ride.
You hurting?
No, not quite.
Yeah, end of an era, man. End of an era that started off really well, and then it got really ugly to the point that I think most Patriots fans wanted to move on from Mac Jones, and I have no ill will towards Mac whatsoever. I hope that he catches on in Jacksonville, maybe gets a couple of starts and plays well. I think that it was a bad situation for Mac. I don't think that he handled himself particularly well at times, as I alluded to earlier, but yeah. I don't have anything against Mac Jones. I just, at this point, the fact that the Patriots got the third overall pick, I think it's a really huge thing for them because of the fact that, say, and they could have easily won a couple of more games down the stretch here, say they ended up with the seventh pick or the sixth pick, would we be having conversations right now about Mac Jones potentially being the starter again? I know you still have Zappe here who's happy that Mac's gone, apparently. I know those guys didn't get along, as Callahan's told us before. Like, not that they didn't like each other, they just like didn't talk. Or Doug told us that. Somebody told us they didn't really talk. But the point being is, if you didn't have this top three pick, Mac Jones may be on the roster. Right? Mac Jones may be on the roster, and you may say, hey, it's between him, Zappe, and you bring in like a Jacoby Brissett, and you're competing for it. So that's the one thing I'm really happy about, is the fact that we can just move on from this situation. And the Patriots have to be happy about this too, that they can just move on from this situation and be in a position where they can just start over at the quarterback position, because we were really close to not being there. We were really close to having a situation where the quarterback position, the quarterback room, if you will, could have been as bad as last year.
Yeah, I mean, I think I got to give a shout out to my guy, Kyler Murray, frankly. Like, the fact that he came back, I thought they were going to put him on ice the entire season, the Cardinals. And just because they didn't, he won a couple games. I mean, if we were one pick out of the running, if we had the fourth pick, I feel like we might be having this conversation. So, definitely glad we got a crack at one of these guys. Because I think, as we saw with Mac Jones, there's a huge difference between having the three pick and having the 15th pick. I mean, it just feels like, I don't know, I've just been thinking, I heard what you said about Mac, and it's all true. I just, my big takeaway from the whole era is, like, what an unbelievable reach he was at 15. It's just, that's all I can think about. It's just, like, his ceiling was being slightly above average as a quarterback, and that's just, like, not what you should be going for with the 15th pick, and I can't get over that. It just feels like that was a lesson learned.
Well, I think at that point, the Patriots are, and look, there's a lot of reporting that Kraft really wanted Mac. But at that point, remember, you had just come off the Cam Newton season, where basically like the vertical passing element was not really part of the Patriots offense. So if Bill, and remember, famously, and I can't remember which book it is now, it may be Jeff Benedict's book, which The Dynasty is based off, but there was a quote from a former assistant coach at the time, and I still believe that it was Joe Judge, that they thought they could win with any top 15 quarterback.
So arrogant.
And I think, well, yeah, and I think part of the reason is that is because they went 11-5 with Castle. Jimmy Garoppolo, he comes out his first game against Arizona, he looks awesome. First half against Miami, he looks awesome until he ends up injuring the shoulder. And then, and I know they lost the next game, they bust out Jacoby Brissett on a short week on a Thursday night against the Houston Texans. They win. So they probably feel, okay, Mac Jones is never going to be in the Pat Mahomes, Aaron Rodgers type category, right? Tom Brady type category. But we think that he could be top half of the league guy. And if we have a top half of the league guy, we as a coaching staff are good enough to win with that type of player. Now, obviously, the rest of the roster would kill them as well. But I believe that's what the logic was, is they wanted somebody like just come in, run the system type thing. And I think that's what they thought they were getting from Mac. And to their credit, like in 2021, they did go to the playoffs. Yeah. And then it just completely fell apart.
No, I mean, that's fair. And frankly, maybe Mac Jones would have played okay on the 2008 Patriots roster or the 2016 Patriots roster. Like, he might have played well. But, but like, you mentioned those quarterbacks. You mentioned Brissett and you mentioned Garoppolo. With both, I think, third-round picks, not the 15th overall pick.
No, Jimmy was second, and that was a big story. And
right.
In the dynasty, it gets into that. But that was a major issue for Brady. Brady was not too happy about that he was taken in the second round. But the point being is, you make a good point about on the 2008 Patriots, because Castle wasn't great after that, obviously.
Yeah.
But what about if Mac had just gone to a situation like San Francisco, right? Where, remember, that was the rumor at the time. And it was right. Still a rumor after that. Actually, Kyle Shanahan really wanted Mac Jones, but the group there convinced him it's not worth taking about the third overall pick. You got to take somebody with a higher upside. So if he went to a good situation, maybe he would have been like what we saw in 2021 was basically slightly above average quarterback play, right? Could you just give a team that? And look, I don't know if he may just be broken. Who knows? He may just be broken at this point. And I wouldn't want to build my team around it because I feel like everything else sort of has to be in place, right? Like the rest of the team has to be really good. You have to have a really stacked roster. He's never going to elevate the team around him, right? That's why I felt like the whole idea with the weapons, the offensive line, the coaching changes, like it was never going to work. That would have been tough for a star quarterback to work with what was going on with the Patriots. For Mac Jones, a guy with a noodle arm, it was going to be nearly impossible. So they screwed up on the Patriots side of things. But also, I think the biggest thing here is because, as we alluded to, the fact that they have the third overall pick, the other portion of this is it was so bad that it got to the point where now you have a mulligan. Start over.
Yeah. No, I'm happy about that. And luckily, we're going to get a guy because, like, Mac Jones just didn't have any elite physical traits. And you're either going to get Jalen Daniels, who's really, really fast, or Drake May, who's got a really, really big arm. And I just feel like you need one of those things if you're going to be a great quarterback. And I want a great quarterback if you're going to use a first-round pick.
Yeah, the one thing, though, were any of those guys childhood actors or childhood models, I should say? Remember Mac? Mac Jones? Mac is like a childhood model.
You bring up a very good point, Brian.
So he's been used to the spotlight, although couldn't handle the New England spotlight.
Now he's going back home, warmer weather.
What's the signature Mac game? The three throw game?
Oh, you mean in terms of his highlights or lowlights?
No, his highlight.
Well, you know what? Someone mentioned today, there was that game this year where they beat the Bills and they had that like walk-off touchdown.
Oh, yeah. That's definitely the game.
I'll give him that. I'll give him that. I think signature lowlights, though. There were a couple pick sixes that really seared into my brain, but I'm going to give it to the game in Germany when he threw that little noodle pick to the Colts or whatever. I think that was when Jonathan Graf said Belichick's done kind of thing. But that, for me, was a breaking point.
Yeah, that's when the report came out that Belichick was done after that.
Yeah, that was a rough pick. I think that was like maybe 10 miles an hour, that ball.
Another game, by the way, that Mac was pulled from.
Yes. I like that. I noticed though, the Zappy liking that Instagram post. That's something.
That dude, man. He's a legend. Yeah. I love Zappy. I mean, I don't want to be the Patriots starting quarterback. Let me make that abundantly clear. But I love that guy. I can't believe he liked that. Because sometimes, like, you know, you're scrolling Instagram and that can happen, right? Where you just like accidentally like something, right? And then you realize you're like, wait, what did I just like? But
yeah,
if it's something like, I'll do it once in a while. Like, I'm scrolling Instagram and I'll like this, like, random story, like, random ESPN story about, like, I don't know, like, Kawhi Leonard or something. I'll be like, why the hell? What? Or Devin Booker. I did it one time. Like, something about Devin Booker. The reason I point that out is just because if you look at Zappy, there's no way that was an accidental like.
No.
Because that story, he thinks that story has a lot to do with him, even though it really doesn't. It's more just about Mac Jones. Like, the Patriots are taking a quarterback third overall, right? So it's just funny to me that he liked that. Like, that's.
I mean, I was thinking maybe it's like a spiteful FU to Mac or something. Like, he's out of town, good riddance kind of thing.
Oh, that's what it is. Yeah, he's pumped.
Yeah, for sure.
He thinks he's pumped. Mac's gone, and he thinks this is clearing the way. He thinks he's the guy now. Hey, Mac's gone. This is my team, baby. Come on.
Maybe Gerard told him something. Maybe Gerard said, we're taking a tackle.
Yeah. He's going to, like, pro athletes should think this way, but he's going to think, like, say it's Jaden Daniels at three or Drake May, whoever, one of those two guys that they're going to draft. He's going to think, like, when that guy comes in, it's my fucking job, man. Okay? This is my job. That's what Zappy's going to think.
There is that talk of Elliott Wolf doesn't like playing rookie quarterback. So I don't know if Zappi's going to be the guy. Maybe they bring in a veteran, but I don't know. It seems like there's been some noise about that, right? It's benching the rookie quarterback the first year, putting him on ice like Aaron Rodgers.
Yeah, maybe they'll try. It's tough to do that for an entire season. I know Mahomes famously did it, right? So it's like Mahomes did it, Rodgers did it, so everybody points to that. But I will say this, because obviously he was with Rodgers, but they had Brett Favre, though. The Patriots have Zappi. The one thing I'll say, though, is like this is a prediction for next season. If Zappi's still on the team, which I think obviously he's going to be, he's under contract, I think there's going to be like a moment in the season where the rookie's not playing well and Zappi talks to the media about like he should be the guy. Hey, we want to win. We got to play something like that. You know what I mean?
We'll see, Brian. It's going to be interesting to see how the entire team talks to the media post Belichick. We might be, the Wild West with comments and stuff to the press.
Well, Zappi was already that way.
He was.
Zappi's like the most non-patriot of all time with the media.
Right. Now he's going to be unleashed.
Yeah. All right, Jamie. Good stuff, man.
Thank you, Brian.
All right. As always, make sure to get your voicemails in 617-396-7172. Email your thoughts and questions to offthepike@gmail.com. Thanks to Jamie McClellan and Steve Cerruti for producing this podcast, and we'll chat in a couple of days. Must be 21 plus and present in select states. FanDuel is offering online sports wagering in Kansas under an agreement with Kansas Star Casino, LLC. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER or visit FanDuel.com/RG in Colorado, Iowa, Kentucky, Michigan, New Jersey, Ohio, Pennsylvania, Illinois, Tennessee, Vermont, and Virginia. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP or text NEXTSTEP to 53342 in Arizona, 1-888-789-7777, or visit ccpg.org/chat in Connecticut, 1-800-9-WITH-IT in Indiana, 1-800-522-4700, or visit ksgamblinghelp.com in Kansas, 1-877-770-STOP in Louisiana, visit mdgamblinghelp.org in Maryland, visit 1800gambler.net in West Virginia, or call 1-800-522-4700 in Wyoming. Hope is here. Visit gamblinghelplinema.org or call 800-327-5050 for 24/7 support in Massachusetts or call 1-877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY in.
This episode is brought to you by Hotels.com. When I went on my last holiday to Cape Town, it was amazing. My friends were there, the weather was phenomenal, and most importantly, the food was fantastic. But one thing I struggled with was finding the right places to stay. You know, all I want is a great bed, a fantastic shower, and breakfast that doesn't end at 8 a.m. I'm on holiday, I'm still sleeping. I also like ease, and the Hotels.com app easily helps me to find a perfect hotel for every trip. Whether you're looking for a family-friendly getaway or a relaxing spa weekend, on the Hotels.com app, you can compare up to 5 hotels side by side. Now, why would you want to do that? So you can see prices, amenities, and star ratings. And best of all, you don't have to switch back and forth between options. See? Ease. So, start planning your next getaway and find your perfect somewhere in the Hotels.com app today.